All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a packed show, and I'm going to plow right through everything today, all right, because there's a whole lot of important stuff that we're going to be talking about. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with the writer, director, and two of the actors from this play, Blood, which I saw last week and which really knocked my socks off, and it's a really important play, something that's really got to be in people's heads today, all right, so we'll be looking forward to doing that. In the middle of the show, we're going to be listening to a piece from Bob Avakian called Why Do People Come Here? From all over the world, actually, people come here, and this is getting into why they come here. And that fits in with what our first segment is all about, all right? Just a little while ago, a Department of Justice immigration judge made headlines for testifying that 3- and 4-year-old migrant children could be taught immigration law and could competently represent themselves in court. Now, that's the opening paragraph of an op-ed piece that was written by my first guest, Hector Viagra. And Hector is the executive director of the ACLU of Southern California. And we're going to be talking with Hector today on the tens of thousands of immigrant children who are going through the deportation hearings in this country without any counsel representing them and what it means and where the hell it's coming from and everything else. Hector, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Yeah, it's great to have you back, man. It seems we're always talking about something so outlandish that it just makes your blood curdle.
When you think it can't get any more outrageous, right?
Right. Well, why don't you explain to people exactly what this judge, Jack H. Weil, did?
Well, amazingly, in a deposition in a federal case, he testified, as you described, that he could explain immigration law to 3- and 4-year-old migrant children facing deportation. And he said it wasn't easy, but it could be done, and that the hearings could be carried out, and they would be fair hearings. He said that ultimately children would understand it and get it, and they would be able to participate and adequately defend themselves.
And as I read in various other newspaper accounts, actually, a lot of people have been making the point that, like, when you're 3 and 4 years old, that you're lucky if you can piece the right words together to make a whole sentence. It's sort of like...
That's right. You almost wonder if he's ever actually met a 3 or 4 year old. I have 3 young children, and at that age, you know, you're hoping that maybe you get a noun and a verb together. You're hoping they don't, put the wrong thing in their mouth and choke on it. You're hoping that, you know, they share their toys with other kids. It's very, very basic stuff that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the thought that they would be capable of understanding what an asylum claim would be, or the elements of some form of humanitarian relief, is just preposterous.
And it's preposterous, and the whole idea it just reeks of the most savage inhumanity and dehumanizing of all kinds of people. I mean, because it's more than just what's happening to these kids. It's so outrageous that it's happening to these kids. But it says something about how the U.S. is actually dehumanizing whole sections of the population of the world, and it gets centered on something like this.
Absolutely. The inhumanity, the lack of empathy for a fellow human being in a situation like this, what a lot of folks, I think, either don't understand or don't want to understand is these kids are not coming here. They're not economic migrants. They are fleeing principally 3 countries, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. And those 3 countries are the most dangerous on the planet. They have the highest murder rates of anywhere in the world. And so they aren't coming here for jobs or economic opportunity. They're fleeing for their lives, and they're fleeing criminal gangs and drug cartels that are essentially threatening them if they won't join in their illegal activities, and they will kill them if they don't. And if their family members won't join, they will get targeted as well. And that's what this is about, is what these kids are fleeing from. And if we don't give them a fair process, we risk sending kids back to this violence and murder who might actually have a very valid claim to remain here. And in fact, you know, the United Nations did a study a couple of years ago as these kids started to come in larger and larger numbers. And they estimated that as many as 60% of these kids might actually have a valid claim to remain in the United States under either U.S. or international law.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but there's one thing I wanted to actually point out, too, is that part of what's so enraging about this, and actually people should listen to this and think about the kind of exposure of what the character of this imperial country is, because when you look at it, a lot of, you know, the sort of irony is when you're talking about that these countries have actually one of the largest murder rates and kill rates and the, you know, violence and all this stuff in the world. you know, at the same time, a lot of what happened, they weren't just like naturally that. It's not like that's not the nature of those countries. But actually, the irony here is that a lot of the gangsters that are, you know, dealing in the drug world and are actually having the gang wars in these various countries and causing a lot of the killings and all this other stuff were actually deported themselves from the U.S. And the gangs that were actually created in the U.S. when people came here out of for whatever reason and tried to survive and came together in an age-old story of, you know, you get together and there's some underworld stuff going on and all this. But then the deportations of all these people, and they go back into a country where people can barely stay alive for, you know, I mean, you look at the lifespan and whatnot of people in these countries, and it's tremendously difficult for people to live, and these gangs actually offer yet another way, and like the same gangs themselves actually are the gangs that were deported from the U.S. and are now springing up and torturing the people in El Salvador and elsewhere.
Absolutely. You have so many people who are acting as if the United States was an innocent bystander in all of this, and you're absolutely right to point to those deportations that have essentially exported a lot of this to these countries. And I think you also have to remember that a lot of U.S. policy has involved, has focused on destabilizing these governments and putting people in power who were friendly to us and maybe weren't as good a leader for their people as they should have been. So in many ways, we bear a lot of responsibility for the fact that these kids are actually coming now to our doorstep.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I want people to know, just so we can everybody be on the same plane when we're here. This judge is not just, this is not the mumblings of a deranged judge that's actually about to get sort of put out the pasture. This is actually a fairly significant person in the whole court system, right? And why, I want you to talk to that, and then why people should take what he's saying serious, take him serious.
Yes, this is really what's stunning. So the attorney in our office who took his deposition was stunned when he heard these words come out of this judge's mouth. So he actually went back to this topic four or five times to make sure that he was understanding what this judge said, and the judge every time reiterated. But you're absolutely right. We did not pick this person at random. We asked the government to present in our lawsuit the person who they deemed most knowledgeable on the topic of children in deportation proceedings. The government looked around, and they picked this judge, Judge Weil. He is a senior judge. He is a supervisory judge who is actually responsible for training immigration judges on how to handle deportation cases involving children. And he actually carries these cases out himself. So you have this ridiculous position now where the government is disavowing the comments that he made, but they handpick this guy to make these statements. And he is somebody who is a participant in this very system. And to me, one of the things that really stands out in all of this is if the government does not believe that kids can represent themselves, and Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General, actually said this a few days later in testimony before the Senate. She said that the Department of Justice does not take the position that kids can represent themselves, and she actually did not limit it to 3- and 4-year-olds. She said any child. So if you grant that, then there is no way that these hearings should continue because they are patently unfair. But that's precisely what the government is doing. The government is moving ahead with these cases and actively trying to deport these children, even though they don't have attorneys defending them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me first remind people that we're talking with Hector Viagra, who's the executive director of the ACLU of Southern California, and we're talking about the recent revelation that was put out of how people actually, how children as young as 3 years old or maybe even younger are not, they're basically a federal judge has said that these kids can actually defend themselves when they're facing deportation in these various immigration courts. Now, Hector, tell me this. You know, let's talk about the repercussions of this, because I don't think people understand that this isn't just one thing that's happening, you know, every now and then, like a couple times a week you get this. This is a fairly heavy thing. I mean, a huge percentage of the children who end up in these courts are actually children who are not, basically not allowed to have an attorney.
That's right. That's right. There has been about 50,000 cases pretty much over the last 3 years, and the great majority of the children are going unrepresented. And as you would expect, the kids who are unrepresented fare much worse than the kids who are represented. So the statistics show that if you don't have a lawyer, you're five times more likely to be deported than if you did.
Man, well, I'll tell you, you know, one of the things I saw, too, is that, you know, even when you're talking about that, when you raise that statistic, And you're thinking about this. And actually, one of the things I saw is that, you know, you're a kid in a courtroom, and I don't care if you're 3 years old or you're 12 years old, and you're being grilled by Homeland Security attorneys. And you're being pushed, you know, basically things are being put in your face. All kinds of questions are being asked to you. And the kind of answer that you give, actually, your future could ride on that. And I think
it's,
go ahead, talk about that, because I think that's one of the things people don't realize either. You know, it's these are kids faced off against these honchos that are sort of, you know, these big Homeland Security guys that are coming in and just basically ideologically and politically beating the hell out of these kids.
I think that if you want your heart to be broken, you should go to immigration court and watch one of these hearings, because you have on one side of the courtroom, you have a child sitting at a table. Maybe they're accompanied by an interpreter, but that's it. And on the other side, what do you have? You have an adult representing the United States government who is trained in the law, who is trained specifically in immigration law, and whose job is to essentially make the case that that child should be deported. So that the expectation on that child is that they'll understand what the test is for being entitled to, say, asylum, that they will understand what kind of evidence that they're going to need to present, what kind of testimony that they will need to give that would establish their entitlement to that claim. That is just ridiculous to think that a child can be, you know, paired off against a trained adult, a professional adult, and have it be a fair adjudication of that child's rights.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I keep thinking, like, what's the analogy? And there's nothing I would let my child argue for if their rights were really at stake that could compare to this. If the school says that my child was late returning a book at the library, I wouldn't let them fight that out themselves. I would go in and do it. And to think that the government would leave this momentous issue of whether this child should remain here or be deported, where they will face certainly violence and maybe death, leave that solely in the hands of the child is just absolutely unconscionable.
Mm-hmm. And actually, just so people are clear, a wrong answer when you're a kid being grilled by these Homeland Security attorneys, a wrong answer actually can mean the difference between life and death for you.
Yes. Yes, and you could simply have misspoken or not really understood the impact of what you were saying or the import of what the government was getting at or the inference that the government is going to draw from it. It is really just far too much to ask a child to be able to make those kinds of judgments and calculations when potentially their life is at stake.
Now, Hector, one of the things that you guys are fighting this out on, it seems like, on two levels. There's the level of morality and the immorality of actually doing something like this. But then there's also this whole point about constitutional rights. And I know that the government is actually doing a lot of fast talking around this, you know, saying that it's wrong for children to be representing themselves in immigration courts, but the law doesn't provide for the right to an attorney. And let's talk about that.
Yes, yes. It's one of those things where it's amazing to hear a government official testify in this way. It's almost Orwellian, where the attorney general says, yes, we agree, these kids cannot represent themselves. They should have attorneys, but there's nothing that requires us to provide an attorney, so we won't, and so we're going to move ahead with deporting these children. That's fine as a matter of federal immigration law. She is absolutely correct when she says that there is nothing in immigration law that requires the appointment of counsel. But let's not forget that we have a constitution that sits above whatever laws Congress has enacted. And that constitution provides for due process for anybody in the United States. Whenever the government is going to make some kind of decision that affects that individual's rights. And the greater the impact on an individual's rights, the more protection you need to offer. So here, when a child is threatened with deportation, and deportation is an incredibly serious action that the government intends to take against an individual, remove the person from the United States. And you add to that the fact that they would be removed, many of these children, to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, which, as we said, are so dangerous and violence and murder are so prevalent. You have to do more to protect against a mistake. And when you are expecting a child to represent themselves, as you said, any minor slip-up could cost that child their life. So it is incumbent on the government to do more to protect the rights at stake. And so our argument is that due process actually does require, in this situation, the appointment of counsel.
You know, one of the things that got me, and it's just sort of because it's such a venal, such a low level, you know, thing around this. Even if eventually they said, well, you know, you might have an arguable case here, but we'll fight it out with you in terms of right to due process. Then they say, and this is the thing that gets me, and people should listen to this because this is sort of thematically part of what the show is about today. You know, that if you see something wrong, you've really got to stand up and do something about this. And the government has said that, well, you know, listen, really what it comes down to is, hey, the cost of providing an attorney for children facing deportation is just too high for the taxpayers to pay. You know, it's really, again, this constant push to dehumanize people who have been forced from their, forced from their country, forced from their home. And even a lot of these kids who've come here looking for their parents who were forced from their home to try and get a job up here and send money back to be able so their kids will be able to live. And you have this massive thing. And then the idea, the audacity of saying, well, taxpayers can't afford to pay for a lawyer.
Yeah, yeah. This sort of cost-benefit analysis, you know, it's not worth spending a little bit of money here to protect the lives of these kids because they really ultimately don't matter. A lot of that really does undergird what's going on here. And when we talk about the Constitution, when we talk about a value like due process or fundamental fairness, I think what people have to understand is that our values are tested not when it's easy, but when it's hard to adhere to them, when there's a cost associated, when there's a price to pay. If it were a matter of providing due process and there were no cost to us, of course, due process would be an incredibly easy concept. The reason it's written into our Constitution is that we will want to run away from due process precisely when there is a cost associated with it. And here, I just don't think that that's a valid argument. The government actually is expending tons of resources hiring federal prosecutors to move against these kids. You know, if they wanted to level the playing field, what they could do is not have a paid prosecutor in these cases. You could level the playing field by eliminating the prosecutor and saving money if they wanted to. But of course, they never mention that kind of possibility. And ultimately, you know, even if they don't want to go through this step of hiring and appointing counsel, there actually is something they could do that doesn't cost money, and yet they won't do that either. And so we've heard a lot from the president over the last couple of years about prosecutorial discretion and priorities of enforcement. What they could do is prioritize the cases of those kids that are represented, move the kids who are unrepresented to the back of the line, and hopefully in the intervening time period, they might be able to find an attorney, or maybe once a case of a child who is represented gets resolved, that attorney gets freed up and can then represent some of these other kids. That is a way of providing due process, right? You're going to proceed only against those kids who are represented. But the government won't do that either. So what really is this about?
Mm-hmm. All right, Hector, you know, one of the things I think we really got to move on. But I got to tell you, I keep thinking as we're talking that the idea that there's any human being on the planet who is illegal is just something that, one, I think it's really inherently, it's rooted in every aspect of this system, capitalism, in terms of what they've done to countries all over the world, what they've done to people, forced people, the situations they forced people into. I wanted you to, you know, and I think it's something that people have to think about hard because, you know, these are children, and we're talking about tens of thousands of children who are being, as Hector said, being sent back into hell, basically. And Hector, I wanted you to tell people real quick, we've got about a minute left, where can people go to find out more information about this and what they can do?
Certainly. And as you say, there are still many kids affected by this. There are, I think, are 60,000 cases involving kids in deportation, many of whom are unrepresented. Folks should definitely go to the ACLU website, the ACLU of Southern California website. Public counsel is one of our co-counsel in the case. You can find information there as well. There are any number of charities that are looking for funding or actually looking for lawyers for these children. There's KIND, Kids in Need of Defense. Catholic Charities does a really good job of finding lawyers for folks. So if folks do want to get involved and want to offer some assistance, they definitely can.
All right, Hector Viagra, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
All right, talk to you again soon, man. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Hector Viagra, who's the director of the ACLU in Southern California, and we've been talking about the just the horrendous situation with kids in immigration courtrooms and being left to without attorneys, without any way to fight for their rights or anything else, and being deported into countries that are just that the U.S. has made into murderous hellholes. So that's another great mark on the U.S. imperialist reputation there.
All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
The line, the brave ride, might take arms, legs, and lives. Just the lucky and the strong survive. Even strong have died. They say it's better in the north. Am I wrong to try? Used to go to Guatemala, now I start in Ariaga, Chiapas. 13 hours and it pulls into a haka. Some didn't make it, hurt the screaming and the drama. Hurt the violence and the silence, train tracks and the trauma. Tired, poor, huddled, and yearning to breathe free. The stench of gangs, predators, crooks, and thievery. A better life promised through cruelty we've seen. For real, still hoping for truth in these dreams.
Welcome back. That was La Bestia, taken from the CD Los Dreamers, and it's featuring Ceci Bastida and Raka Iri Science. Now, as I was thinking about the situation that Hector Villagra just spoke about, and not only the tens of thousands of immigrant children that face deportation, but the millions of migrants who are forced to live in the shadows,
I thought that there's a really important piece that I wanted to play from Bob Avakian, and it's from his talk, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And Bob Avakian is the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this piece is really important for people to think about in terms of what we've just been talking about. It's called Why Do People Come Here from All Over the World? So check this out, and we'll be back after a please.
Now I can just hear these reactionary fools saying, well, Bob, answer this. If this country is so terrible, why do people come here from all over the world? Why are so many people trying to get in, not to get out? Maybe we can imagine someone like Vice President Dick Cheney, that crooked mouth monster and worldwide mass murderer. Maybe we can imagine him saying something like this. Yes, Bob, why is that? Why? I'll tell you why. Because you have f***ed up the rest of the world even worse than what you have done in this country. You have made it impossible for many people to live in their own countries as part of gaining your riches and power. Besides everything else that I've mentioned, let's look at what they did in the Congo back in the early 60s and the effect this has had right up to today. The Congo used to be a colony of Belgium. It was the most brutal kind of colonization, working the people literally to death in the mines and other places. They worked them so viciously, literally like slaves, and if they didn't work hard enough, the overseers there would cut off the hands of the people. Finally, after World War II, the people of the Congo got rid of the domination and colonization by Belgium. And they set out to try to build a new country for themselves, and a leader emerged, Lumumba, who was a very popular leader among the people in the Congo. An election was held, and Lumumba won very clearly. But because he was setting out to overcome this legacy of colonialism and all domination by imperialism, the U.S. would not allow it. They maneuvered, they trapped him, they got him into a situation where he was taken and assassinated. And what did they do in place of Lumumba? What did they bring to the people of the Congo? Mobutu, a vicious, brutal tyrant backed by the U.S., kept in power for decades, plundering the people of his own country, building up and amassing tremendous wealth while the people were suffering worse and worse. And then they say, well, see, these people aren't ready for independence. They can't handle their own affairs. Look what happens when they get their independence. Yeah, look what happens. and look deeper and see why. To understand how this system works and how it controls and shapes people's lives, let's look at how people from Mexico and black people end up living alongside each other in somewhere like Watts in Los Angeles or New Jersey or New York City today. It's 1780 or 1800, and someone is walking through their home village in Africa. Maybe they're taking care of a few cattle. Maybe they're tending a few crops. Maybe they're just out for a walk and enjoying the sunny day in the summer. Whatever, all of a sudden they're grabbed and a rope is thrown around them. They're dragged away, never again to see their village or their loved ones. They're transported to a seacoast where they're sold to slave traders, thrown in the hold of a ship under the most horrific and unimaginable conditions, piled together. If you've ever seen drawings, diagrams of slave ships, people packed together, cargo, as they were called. Rats crawling over you day and night, slop at most to eat, never even allowed up on deck to even get any fresh air. If bad conditions arose on the seas, storms developed, the slave ship owners would go among the cargo, the human beings, and decide which one should be thrown overboard so they could save the rest of the cargo so they could make a profit. And through all that horror, you're finally brought to the Americas. Have everything stripped away from you, even your identity. Forced to slave, the people forced to slave away for generations. As the old saying goes, from can't see in the morning till can't see at night. After all the unbelievable horror of what I just described on the slave ship, the Middle Passage, for millions, where millions and perhaps tens of millions died, and those who survived were subjected to these unbelievable conditions of slavery. After generations and centuries of that, finally comes the Civil War. You're promised an end to oppression. You're promised you'll get land and a means for farming the land, 40 acres and a mule. But the promise is broken. After a few years of Reconstruction, in which a few people got some rights and a little bit of land and property, people were stripped of all that and subjected to all the kind of terror and lynching that I've talked about here. This goes on also for generations. The KKK and the rest of it, forcing you to remain on the plantations, terrorizing you into working for the man, being cheated even when you do work. Finally, after World War II, you're driven off the land. You seek a better life. You go to the city or you go to the north. And what do you face? Once again, betrayal. You are segregated once again, terrorized now by the police. You end up in a housing project that's being allowed and deliberately constructed to rot away. In ancient Mexico, in the beginning of the 1500s, the Spanish conquistadores arrive in what they call the New World. The Spanish conquerors destroy the old ways of life and work people to death in the mines and on plantations called haciendas. This old way of life was not free of exploitation and oppression and plunder, but the Spanish did not come to liberate the people or to do away with exploitation, oppression, and plunder. They came to institute their own and even worse and far more vicious form of exploitation and plunder, literally working people to death in the mines and on the haciendas, destroying their culture, taking away everything from them. About 150 years ago, after Mexico became independent from Spain, the U.S. waged war on Mexico and stole a large part of its territory. One of the main reasons for this is that the slave owners in the southern U.S. needed more land. The U.S. replaced Spain and other European colonial powers as the force dominating and plundering Mexico. The Mexican Revolution in the early part of the 1900s promised land to the peasants, but there was never a fundamental change, and the masses of people were still trapped in a situation of being exploited as poor peasant farmers while their country is plundered by the U.S. Throughout the 20th century, and even more so in recent years, the ever greater domination of farming in Mexico by big American agricultural companies has ruined the livelihood of millions of more peasant farmers in Mexico, who were already living in poor and desperate conditions, but were driven further into such desperate conditions, so much so that they could no longer survive by farming. The Mexican government goes into more and more debt to big banks and financial institutions in the rich countries, especially the U.S. And then, at the insistence of the U.S., it cuts off aid to the peasants who are still trying to survive by farming in Mexico. In effect, the government forces them to grow crops that get sold internationally on what is called the world market, which is controlled by the rich countries and their financial institutions. But the Mexican peasants cannot compete in this world market. They cannot make a living. They can barely survive, if they can survive at all, by farming. Writing in our party's newspaper, The Revolutionary Worker, in 1994, shortly after an uprising in Chiapas in the southern part of Mexico, Michael Slate gave a sharp example of this. He wrote about what has happened to Mexican agriculture over the past 30 years. Now, agri means having to do with the land, so agriculture is a way of life based on the land. Slate described how over the last 30 years, Mexican agriculture has been greatly damaged by even more deeply mixed in with and dependent on the world market. Peasant farmers growing things not for their own needs and not necessarily for what is needed in Mexico itself, but what can be sold to big buyers all over the world. Once again, a world market dominated by companies controlling billions of dollars. Deeply in debt and under pressure from the World Bank, which itself is dominated by the U.S., the Mexican government promoted crops that could be sold on the world market in order to try to pay off this debt that it was sinking deeper and deeper into. Land and resources were shifted away from basic food production, and the results have been a disaster for the peasants. In Chiapas, for example, most peasants used to grow corn and beans, but over the years, many switched to growing coffee for export. When the price of coffee fell on the world market in 1990, thousands of Mexican peasants were ruined. And in a recent issue of our newspaper, the RW, there's another article detailing more fully how imperialist domination from the U.S. through things like NAFTA and other ways have further ruined the peasants in Mexico. Another thing mentioned in that article is the maquiladoras in Mexico, just inside the border with the U.S. These are factories that are set up by U.S. companies. They move away from the U.S. and put them just over the border in Mexico. And that line there, that border, is the difference between wages that are 10 times higher on the U.S. side and 10 times lower on the Mexico side. And who works in these maquiladoras? People who can no longer live in the interior, in the countryside, on the farmlands of Mexico, and especially many women, who are not only brutally exploited, but also sexually harassed on the job, and many have been murdered coming to and from the job in these border areas. But even that's not enough. Now many of the maquiladoras are being closed down on the border, while some new ones are being built further in the interior of Mexico in order to take advantage of people who are impoverished there. And still others are being moved to other places, in Asia and elsewhere, where people can be worked for even lower wages because they're even more desperate. So through all this, you find yourself having to leave your home and your homeland in Mexico to go to El Norte, the USA, where you face discrimination and exploitation, living in fear every day of the immigration police, La Migra, if you don't have the necessary papers. You too end up in Watts, or in New York City, or New Jersey, or other cities in the U.S. In the early 80s, there was a movie starring Jack Nicholson and Elpidia Carrillo called The Border, which dramatically showed the kinds of hardships that drive people and the promises and illusions that call them to cross the border from Mexico into the U.S. And it showed the hardships they suffer once they come to the U.S., the ways in which they are treated as aliens and how they are exploited and brutalized in so many ways. The following lines from the theme song of that movie give a powerful sense of what this means. The bitter disappointment that is found in the so-called promised land of the USA and the many ways in which people are still hemmed in by the visible and invisible borderline. Now, my voice is hoarse, but I'm going to give this a try. There's a land, so I've been told, every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline. And when it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson you must learn. You will lose more than you'll ever hope to find. And when you reach the broken promised land, every dream slips through your hand, and you'll know it's too late to change your mind. 'Cause you paid the price to come this far, just to wind up where you are, and you still just across the borderline. For oppressed people who have been through all this, what sense does it make to fight over the crumbs the oppressors leave us, or to fight for control of things we can never really control under this system, including the very neighborhoods we live in, the neighborhoods they have forced us into while they run these neighborhoods down? What sense does it make to fight each other like that when we are part of the same class of exploited and oppressed people who can rise up together to put an end to all this? There is a whole long and bitter history in this country and all over the world of the oppressors getting one people they are oppressing to fight against another, all for the benefit of the oppressors themselves. Think about the experience of the Buffalo Soldiers. Bob Marley wrote a song about this. Danny Glover made a movie about it. But the reality is that these were soldiers, black soldiers, who after the Civil War wanted to prove that they were loyal Americans, that they would earn their place now that they won their so-called freedom. And what were they put to doing? Slaughtering the native peoples, finishing them off in their own home territories, carrying forward the genocide against the native peoples and the theft of their land and the resources in their land. It's a bitter lesson. On the other side of the picture, you have the experience of the Cherokees in America. Back in the 1800s, Old Hickory, Andrew Jackson, the great example of American democracy in evidence as president of the United States, and by the way, a slave owner, convinced some of the leaders of the Cherokees that they could get in on all the goodness of America, and he allowed them to purchase plantations. And they even went ahead and purchased slaves and ran slave plantations. But then a few years later, Andrew Jackson and those who ruled the U.S. decided the land was too valuable for Cherokees to have it. So they were driven out of there and sent on a horrific march toward Oklahoma, a death march where especially old people and children died by the wayside, what became known as the Trail of Tears. Another bitter lesson. But the greater lesson is this. We have reached the point in human history and the development of human society where we don't have to be trapped in this kind of situation and played like this anymore. We have the basis. We have the basis not only to unite those who are oppressed under this system, but to sweep away all this garbage they want to keep getting us caught up in, to sweep away the source of all this, their system itself. Now, next, I'm going to get into how all these things flow from the very nature of the system and why it cannot be reformed. It must be done in and done away with. We need a revolution, the most radical revolution in the history of humanity. And I'm going to be talking about what this revolution is all about. But first, it's time for a break and intermission.
Nice. You see how timely that was? He's not here, and he actually said, it's time for a break and intermission. But before we do that, I just want to let people know, if you've been listening to this and you've been thinking, damn, I want to know more about what that cat is saying, who he is and what he's saying and what he's talking about, and you're tired of the world, you're sick of the world the way it is, and you want to change it, and you want to find out how to really fundamentally change it, you got to get into, you got to investigate, you got to check out Bob Avakian. He's the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
And you can find many of his works by clicking on the Bob Avakian tab at revcom.us. The talk that we just listened to is taken from a bigger talk called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And that's available at revolutiontalk.net. And there's also a whole lot of shorter videos available on the Revolution Talk YouTube channel. So check that out.
We are going to be coming right back after a short intermission where you're going to hear something that's going to knock your socks off. And then we'll be coming back and talking to the people who are responsible for this. All right. So check this out.
By the Japanese government, but they deny it. I know there is no cure for AIDS, and that soon I will die. I would like the man who did this to me to tell me they're sorry.
Lord God Almighty, won't you give us all a rest? Lord God Almighty, give us all a goddamn rest.
All right. You got that? You heard that? That's from the play Blood.
With drama, comedy, song, and dance, the play Blood tells the story of the struggle to uncover a heinous crime that occurred in Japan in the 1980s. In the U.S., it was discovered that blood supplies worth millions of dollars were contaminated with HIV, and they could no longer be sold in the U.S. So the pharmaceutical companies, in collusion with the Japanese health ministry, sold the blood to Japan. And around 2,000 patients, many of them hemophiliacs, were given transfusions, developed AIDS, and died of the incurable disease.
I'm going to be talking with the writer and director of the show, Robert Allen Ackerman, and actors from the show, Kazumi Aihara.
Yes.
And Miho Ando.
Yes.
Okay. And welcome to the show, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Glad
thanks
to
for
be
having
here.
Us.
Thank you for having us.
For having us.
Yeah. Well, you know, I went to see the play last Friday night, and I was really stunned. In a good way, you know, not supposed to be.
Oh, good.
As opposed to being hit with a baseball bat. But it was actually, no, I mean, it was one of those things where you go and you suddenly find this out. You walk into it and you don't know what to expect, you know. And you walk into it and it's kind of a whole different thing. And I was really, I couldn't stop talking about it. Bob, I want to talk to you first. Where did this come from? What brought you to this?
Actually, that's exactly what happened. I was brought to it. I didn't go to it. I was brought to it. I was working in Tokyo, directing a play there, and I was approached by, we're going back like 30 years, when this actually was going on in Japan. What the play is about was actually happening at the time. I was approached by a company called Fuji, which everybody knows, Fuji Film, you know. They're huge. They're a movie company, television company, and they were very interested in making a film about the content of what Blood is about. However, nothing like that had ever been done in Japan, a movie that was so political. And they didn't feel that a Japanese could actually do that and get away with it. So they thought maybe I could do it. So they gave me a mountain of research material all of the articles that had been written up until that time, the newspaper articles, the magazine articles. I even had videotapes of the people who were involved. And I took all of this stuff back to America, was fascinated by it, and thought, yeah, this would make a really powerful movie. The only thing that they wanted, the only order that they gave me was to make an American character so that the movie would be more universal. And I wrote a treatment, and the American character became a woman journalist. And I went back to Japan with the treatment, and I was warned, actually warned, as is the main character in the play, that if I went ahead and exposed this, I could get a bullet in my head. It was really dangerous at the time to speak out so openly against what was going on in the government. And so I thought, well, it's an interesting subject, but I don't know if I want to die for it. So I put it away and thought, well, that's the end of that. The script then was called The Nine Files. And then things happened, you know, like Fukushima and things like what's going on now in Flint, Michigan with the water. And, you know, it started long before that with the weapons of mass destruction and all of these lies that we've been told by the government. I thought, you know, maybe it's time to bring this out again, bring this story into the light. Mm-hmm. And I decided to take the treatment for a movie and turn it into a play.
You know, it's very heavy, too, because the subject of AIDS, and particularly back at the time when you were actually starting, when you were approached around doing a film around it, at that time, it was, I mean, look, people were being hounded. Their lives were threatened. I mean, you think of, it wasn't Ryan White around that time.
Yes, it was just then.
And you know, so you look at the parallel there, and there's a kid who was basically driven to his grave, you know, he couldn't even die in peace because of all the Neanderthal tax on him. And you think about that happening all over the world. And, you know, it just really struck me, you know, because you're looking at this, you know, AIDS, Japan, all the things that you bring out in that play, you know, are things that really hit at people's hearts and their heads at the same time. And I thought that was really incredible. And I want to ask Kazumi, do you want to do your piece? You came in here prepared to do a little piece so people get a sense of what the play is just from hearing you, and then we'll talk.
Sure.
And you can tell to say who your character is first.
Okay, I play a nurse, Eiko Wasami, who is kind of becomes a whistleblower and just helps the main character, two of the main characters, expose the corruption and the lies. There's no knowing how many of his patients he tested. He sent their blood to America for the test. Most of them came back positive for HIV. He never reported it or told the patients. So the same HIV-positive men and women went on sleeping with their lovers, wives, husbands, strangers, innocently spreading the virus. AIDS had come to Japan. It was bound to be exposed. That's why he went public. He announced that two of his patients died of AIDS to make sure that he got the credit for discovering the disease before someone else did. I heard him say he's hoping the discovery will win him the Nobel Prize. Now there are secret hospital wards all over the country, full of people so emaciated you can even tell their ages. And most of them have no idea what's wrong with them. And the ones who have guessed won't say a thing about it because of the shame. Hospitals hide everything. When a patient dies, the death certificates lie about the cause. And this is going on in every hospital, in every prefecture in the country. Japan's dirty secret. And they're still using the American blood.
Yeah. And you know, you think about that, it's like just the horrendous thought of this all done consciously. You know, all done consciously. It's like we see it again in Flint. In Flint, Michigan, and where people were consciously poisoned. And then you look at this, and people were consciously killed. For what? For the sake of profit and for the rest of this stuff. You know, it's like just incredible. Miho, your character in particular, you play a young guy who's actually, go ahead, you can say who you are.
Yes, I'm playing a boy whose name is Koyo Ninomiya. He's a 11-year-old boy, and he was given AIDS by He was innocently given AIDS by using HIV-tainted blood product. And because he was born with hemophilia, he had to use the blood product. And he had been using the blood product since he was 3. And he was 10, he was informed that he was infected with HIV. He was devastated, of course. But instead of giving up his life, he decided to fight against the government and the pharmaceutical company. So he broke the silence and he became a whistleblower, and because he didn't want this to happen to anyone anymore.
And it was a very big thing for a young kid to do that.
It was a very big thing for anybody to do it. At the time, nobody was willing to do it. I just thought maybe it's important to mention to the audience what the play's about, because none of us have.
I was going to go there.
And think, what are they talking about?
I was going to go there because I realized that as well. But go ahead.
Well, in the early 80s, it was discovered that the American blood supply was tainted with HIV. And so about 6,000 to 10,000 people died using that blood. And at that time, they made the blood, they more or less banned the blood, and it was all supposedly destroyed. But there was a tremendous surplus of it because they couldn't use it anymore in the United States. And the drug companies who had manufactured all of this blood product sold it to foreign countries, Japan being the biggest buyer. And at that time, they called it Vampire Japan, because they bought so much of this tainted blood. And everybody knew. That was what was so shocking about it. As the characters in the play dig deeper and deeper, they find out that everybody was in on it and nobody stopped it.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that you say in terms of, and I'm really looking, I want to squeeze as much as we can into this, but one of the things that you talk about is, and I read an interview with you, somebody was asking you, well, like, you bring in all these different aspects, all these different art forms, make an appearance in the course of the play, and it's really intense, and it's intensely good in terms of, you know, everything from, you know, from my generation, the Three Stooges, okay, to, you know, basically, you know, the Gilbert and Sullivan, all these things that come out, to David Bowie kind of stuff, you know, that's like actually very, and by the way, that musician and that singer is very, very cool, man. It just takes you right there. I really liked it a lot. So if you see him, say, hey, you were great. but here's the thing, you know, you look at this and you were asked about all these questions about why you did it, all this other stuff, and you actually made how you did it and why you combined all these things. And you made a point that I think is, I want to talk with the three of you about, is you said that you conjure up theatricality. And that really struck me in this. It's a very important, you know, thing to be talking about. You conjured up theatricality, you know, and so you presented a very intense contradiction theatrically in a way that actually brought it home for so many people, you know.
Thank you. It was a deliberate choice. When I was writing it as a play, not as a film, it occurred to me that, first of all, that it's an incredibly dark subject. And who, you know, just piling one awful fact on top of another just seemed to me to be too many awful things. And also, quite honestly, I said, I know the interview you're referring to, and I said, I'm not a political analyst, I'm not a historian, I'm not an expert on Japanese culture by any means. I didn't feel at all competent to go in and write the kinds of discussions that these bureaucrats would have had when they decided to go ahead and buy this blood. So I thought, well, how do I approach these guys and make them evil without knowing really how to write them? And what I decided to do was make them evil in the way that Charlie Chaplin is evil in The Great Dictator, to make them really buffoonish and cartoonish, and to use Gilbert and Sullivan and vaudeville and all of that. And then once I did that, I thought, well, now I've introduced music. I've got to introduce music. I have to use it in other ways.
And you did that without undercutting the intensity of the contradiction that you're writing about, you know, and that's what really got me. And I wanted to, because I mean, let me ask you this: what drew you to this? Because this is a, you know, look, this is a play, and your character in particular plays somebody that I want to. And again, we have about 4 minutes or 3 minutes left. If we can squeeze another minute in, we'll be all right. But Bob, you said this thing about how you, I can't remember what it was. Oh, you said that this is a story about taking action against greed, hypocrisy, and corruption. And you went on to say, for you, for me, the enemy is pacifism. Knowing something is wrong, but doing nothing about it and avoiding responsibility. And I wanted to ask you, in terms of how, what drew you to the play, was it related at all to that point? Because that's a central question for your character, too.
Well, I do have that kind of conscious awareness that I think, you know, if you know something is wrong and if you don't say anything, and I guess we are part of the guilt, like Bob, you said. But like he said, I am not a political activist or anything, but I like to be involved in a project that can speak to that kind of issues, like social, just, you know, that deals with social awareness. And I think as an artist, it's our responsibility to tell a story that can inspire other people to talk about issues. You know, I'm not an expert, so I cannot tell you like what's right or wrong, but I can open up a door for discussion.
But if you learn something's wrong, then you got to, you know, you can speak out. That's a, need to. Miho, what about you?
Yeah, like Kazumi said, I'm not an expert as well, but in this play, it opens up the door. It you know, helps to help people to more social awareness what's mm-hmm. really going on. Mm-hmm. And it makes you think.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. All right, you know, we're going to have to run very quickly, but damn, I wish we had more time. But we don't. So once again, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests, Hector Viagra, the executive director of the ACLU of Southern California, Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and Robert Allen Ackerman, Kazumi Ahara, and Mihu Ando from the play Blood. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Alex Brenner, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you have any comments or if you want to write to me for any reason, including if you want to volunteer to work on The Michael Slate Show, which you can do from anywhere in the world, write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And you can like me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter. And we're going out now with War on the Palaces from Refused. Talk to you again next week.